Up next on Downtown, a journalist, author, and environmentalist, the author of a number of books, including Ocean's End, Lobster's Coast, and The Republic of Pirates. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2016, and he'll be presenting the Libby Lecture in Natural Resource Policy this Thursday, 3 o'clock, in the Memorial Union's Bangor Room. The subject is American Democracy on the Brink. A little something light this afternoon as we welcome in Colin Woodard. Colin, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure to join you.
I understand that studying in Eastern Europe back in the late 80s is what really exposed you to the challenges facing the environment?
Yes, both the environment and challenges to democracy. I was an exchange student my junior year abroad, which happened to be the fall of 1989, and I was in Budapest. So when I arrived, it was the Iron Curtain in communism. And when I left a few months later, it wasn't. The Berlin Wall fell and all of those other historic events in that region. And I'd been an eyewitness to it. I'd been studying the region before that. And then I returned. I basically spent most of my 20s, which were the 1990s, based in that part of the world. And in the environment, I mean, if you want to see what the world would have been like without a Clean Air Act or a Clean Water Act, go look back at the archives as to what things looked like in Eastern Europe in 1989 when communism ended, because there were none of those regulations. Pollution was, released in the most economically uncumbersome way possible. You just dig pits and throw toxic waste in the ground, and power plants and such had no air scrubbers or anything. And the net effect was, you couldn't miss the environmental problems. They were front and center. There were towns where at night you couldn't go outside because there'd be a sort of choking toxic fumes in the air where you couldn't breathe. There was a town in Romania, as you approached it, the landscape started turning black, the trees, the houses, the people getting on and off the train, because there was a carbon black factory in the middle of the town, rivers that were terribly polluted. And then the Black Sea, which had been sort of a cradle of humanity, underwent a catastrophic environmental crisis that sort of turned this sea that had nourished, the ancient Greeks and Byzantium and Rome, and had turned it into a sea of jellyfish. So yeah, it was the environmental issues there, covering them as a journalist, that led me into becoming, for quite a bit of time in the 1990s, a sort of globetrotting environmental correspondent. Foreign correspondent meets environmental issues.
Well, let me ask the obvious question. Why do you think authoritarianism and unwillingness to protect the environment seem to go hand in hand?
Well, authoritarian regimes are rarely very good for the environment, because authoritarian regimes tend to also be corrupt. The leaders at the top, the autocrats who run them, are usually ensuring their own self-interest, both monetary and otherwise, and aren't that responsive to what happens to the people that they're governing. And so that's a bad combination. If it's more advantageous to yourself and your cronies to destroy a forest or to, have a toxic waste heap somewhere, then that's what you do. And there's no feedback mechanisms when you're not in a democracy to compel better behavior. So yeah, the public tends to get the bad end of the stick on those kind of things. And in terms of environmental justice, which people talk about a lot, about, poor and vulnerable people not always being the ones who have the toxic waste dumped upon them. Mm. None of that ever happens in autocracy, because that's just not part of the conversation.
Well, we live in a state that has been so dependent on its natural resources. And yet I think historically there's always been the idea that, it'll always be there. I mean, you go back to the days when Percival Baxter wanted to start a state park, and people in the legislature said, well, why would you need to do that? We're all woods as it is. When you published your book on the lobster industry and the fishing industry in Maine, Lobster Coast, was there some blowback from the industry? How did they respond to that?
No, because the book is pretty sympathetic to the lobster industry, precisely because lobstermen figured out a way. There was a terrible period for the resource in the early 20th century. And in the aftermath of that, lobster fishermen themselves had put together a sustainable fishery, right? It's all small boats using traps. The boats are almost, in effect, have to be owner operated. And you throw back the ones that are too small and too big You throw back buried females who have eggs on their underside so they can become breeding stock. And it doesn't have mobile gear that's moving around destroying the habitat upon which the lobster depend. So it sort of championed that. So there wasn't blowback from the lobstering community. It did bring to task the creation of the, factory trawling fleets that wiped out the George's Bank and Grand Banks and a sort of mining extraction approach to fisheries that had been particularly dominant in the 60s and 70s and even the 1980s, and wiped out a lot of resources that we in Maine and coastal Maine communities previously depended on, like inshore cod and the like. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that there was any blowback on that. The surviving brown fishermen have a tough time of it, but I don't think in a, a moment of honesty, anyone in when the book came out in sort of 2004, I guess it was, I don't think anyone would have denied that those resources were not what they had been and that fishing had played a part. So it's about, living within, the ecosystem has certain tolerances and humans have to figure out a way to work within those if in the long run you want to maximize your economic yield from fisheries and have the ecosystem still be producing for you. Not to mention all the other things that the ecosystem may do for you that are not confined to a particular industry or a set of resource harvesters.
We're talking with Colin Woodard here on Downtown. You founded the Nationhood Lab at Salve Regina. Can you talk about how you got it started and the work that's being done there?
Yeah, well, when I was in Eastern Europe, of course, what had happened is totalitarian regimes had collapsed, and there were these efforts to create democracies, and some of those efforts succeeded and some failed and, fell into right-wing autocracies, and there were demagogues with big lies leading people to do terrible things. I covered the aftermath in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and there were all kinds of other ethnic conflicts and the like. Covered a lot of that stuff in other parts of the world and sort of had a trial by fire in understanding how humans think and the ways that societies and individuals are vulnerable to a certain kind of demagoguery in certain situations. And as that those same challenges have come to the United States, my skill set from being in that region, it's suddenly becoming more and more relevant. And I founded Nationhood Lab. We study, I guess you would say, the problems of United States nationhood and how to solve for them, how to protect our democracy, understanding why we're vulnerable, which goes back to a book I wrote called American Nations. We're not and never have been just one America, but we were several Americas because we were colonized by separate colonial projects. The Puritans coming to New England and the, younger sons of the manor lords of the English countryside coming to the Chesapeake and the Dutch setting up their commercial, global city-state trading colony in the mouth of the Hudson and what became Greater New York City, and the West Indies English slave lords who came into the deep south around Charleston and established a West Indies-style slave society in the subtropical lowlands of the US. All these different regional cultures, these colonies didn't think they'd end up in a country together, and they had different ideologies and religious background and had been founded at different times. They had different ideas of the society they were creating. And they all ended up in a country together, and we're still in a country together, but a lot of those deep patterns and ideologies and phenomenon and characteristics from the 17th and 18th century are still with us today and can be seen as you map everything from political behavior to the COVID-19 pandemic to diabetes rates to FICO credit scores. It affects our life profoundly and the contours of our debates. And few people are sort of aware of it because we're a country that's not very good at understanding our history and how history has shaped us. So that's the decoder ring to kind of understand the problem. And then we're working on the sort of some of the solutions in what can hold us together.
I'm old enough to remember going to elementary school in the post-Sputnik era and the emphasis on education, but particularly in science. When did this distrust in science begin in America?
Well, I think there's always been an element of it in American culture. I mean, there was a reaction, if you want to really go back in history, right? The Enlightenment, which was around the time of the founders, had this idea that the world was scientifically knowable and that you could, through, rational Vulcan-like logic, understand it. And there was a counterreaction against that that started in Europe, the Romantics, right? The idea that people are different, and there are these sort of mythic, Lord of the Rings, Ivanhoe, King Arthur kind of backstories to our civilizations that are particular and almost metaphysical, religious and spiritual experiences that boil down into nations, right? That's a motive. And those battles were going on in our country in the early Republic, and a lot of that became a sort of criticism of science. And when the, you know, when you move into the late 18th century and the early 19th, we have a rise in the evangelical movement, especially in the South, of fundamentalist Christianity, who felt that the direction the Enlightenment was taking was contradicting the Bible, which they felt had to be literally true and infallible. And so suddenly science and religion were at each other's throats, especially in large parts of the country. In those same regions where evangelical Christianity really took hold most deeply, which was in what I call Greater Appalachia and the Deep South and Tidewater, but roughly speaking, the southern regions in Appalachia, those experiences were buttressed by the fact that the great immigration wave of the 1880s through 1924 that transformed American ideas about identity, that henceforth we weren't just a Protestant nation, but that Catholics and Orthodox Christians and Jews, at least, would be part of the full-fledged American experience. None of that happened in those same regions I just described because none of the immigrants basically went there. Those regions, by the end of that immigration wave, we were like 1% foreign-born at a time when, say, the greater New England space across the upper Great Lakes and upstate New York and New England was, 25% foreign-born. And the area around New York City that the Dutch had founded was over 30. So, I mean, those were profound differences of identity. And in your question about science, that meant in certain regions of our country, the idea that science had the answer and that rational inquiry would lead to truths that might contradict a literal reading of the Bible, those were all powerful forces that don't really have an equivalent experience, say, in the United Kingdom or Western Europe, that makes our country a bit of an outlier in that regard.
Is there a connection too between race, ethnicity, and belief in the power of authoritarianism?
Not between race and ethnicity, but a lot of political scientists have been looking at a subset of white evangelicals concentrated in those same regions I described, which the academics call white Christian nationalism. And it's less really about Christianity per se, as more of a right-wing movement that uses the sort of veil of Christian belief to enforce a sort of authoritarian ethno-national definition of the country, that we're not devoted to the Enlightenment principles in the Declaration of Independence, the idea that people have these natural inborn rights to equal rights to not be tyrannized, to survive, to pursue happiness as we understand it, and to access the representative self-government. No, that's not the interpretations they go for. It's that this country is was created by and for white evangelical Christians, and it belongs to them, and everyone else is here provisionally. So that's another illustration of a clash between Enlightenment values and, in this case, more fundamentalist ones. So yeah, there's the history has a profound effect on our lives today, even in this country where there's this belief, this fantasy that somehow we transcend history. We left it all behind when our ancestors crossed oceans to come here, and that we're invented again. But history doesn't work that way.
Let's talk about some recent history. What are the implications on the environment by the recent Supreme Court decisions overturning the Chevron doctrine and blocking the good neighbor rule?
Well, there's the present Supreme Court seems to be targeting the ability of the federal government, the administrative state, to enforce a wide range of regulations to, that are geared towards protecting the environment or human health, and sort of gutting the legal principles and all the precedent that has allowed agencies to do these things. In the Chevron case, there was essentially a presumption that members of Congress, cannot possibly understand the incredible scientific and technical minutiae that are required to pass intelligent regulations on all sorts of, substances that are released and additives in food, that's an expertise you have to defer to civil servants who study these things, have degrees in them, and try to work out, you know, carefully and an inquiry as to what the right level should be. So there's a presumption that that the administrators and the civil servants and the experts have worked these things out, and that you should defer to those things. With the Chevron decision, that all goes out the window, and suddenly every single, you know, case can be brought individually against the federal regulations in a way that makes it much harder to enforce them. So yeah, it's an effort to reduce the ability to enforce environmental laws and a other wide range of things to decrease the power of the federal government.
So do we have a clear path forward to both protect and ensure the continuation of democracy and protect the environment?
Well, it's a challenge. You know, we are definitely in probably the most dangerous situation for our republic since the 1860s. And there is a, you know, non-zero possibility of descending into some more authoritarian, ethno-nationalist kind of universe, you know, more like Viktor Orban's Hungary than what we're used to. We do not want that to come to pass. And, you know, polling and analysis, it's clear that the vast majority of Americans, even the majority of people who are Trump supporters, you know, if they take away the political tribal markers and instincts, most people don't want that. Maybe 20% of the population actually wants that ethno-national authoritarian world. That would include that Christian nationalist bloc I described, but the vast majority of people don't. It's just that a lot of people aren't paying attention or are living in misinformation bubbles where they don't realize that that is actually the choice that's before you. You know, if you just watch President Trump's speeches directly and see what he's saying right now on the campaign trail, he's laying it all out.
Yeah.
You know, set down the filters. You don't have to believe, you know, me or the media. Just watch what he's saying at his rallies right now. It's an ethno-national authoritarian promise. You know, targeting right now, it's Haitian immigrants with a lie that they're eating pets somewhere, illegal Haitian immigrants. But it goes on and on from there. So those are the actual stakes. And, you know, the trick is for people to wake up that this is actually the choice that's being made. You know, you may have grievances about, you know, the balance between individual liberty and the common good, between the powers the federal government has, but that's not actually the big binary choice that's in front of us now. Maybe that should be. I mean, we need two healthy parties in our system, which requires basically that we have two parties. You know, we need a healthy center left and center right party. Right now, we only have one party that's still committed to the democratic experiment laid out in the Declaration. We need there to be another, but we're going to need to survive to fight another day, you know, and it's going to be a long-term process. You know, this is something, a crisis that has been building for decades and will take us many years to get back out of.
The Libby Lecture Series, this Thursday, 3 o'clock, the Bangor Room at Memorial Union, American Democracy on the Brink, How We Got Here and the Implications for the Natural Environment. Colin, great talk with you. We appreciate you making some time for us today.
My pleasure.